You are listening to The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. Episode 13, The People on the Brink. Здравствуйте, товарищи. Hello, comrades. In this episode, we will be taking a break from our hyper-focus on the Bolsheviks and Petrograd in order to check in again with the rest of the Russian nation, the peasantry, and the soldiers. But before we get to all that, I have a few points of order I want to discuss briefly. To start, this is the first episode I've been able to put out since doing my guest spots on the podcasts The Deprogram and Movies vs. Capitalism. Oh, if you missed it, I did guest spots on the podcasts The Deprogram and Movies vs. Capitalism. Since those episodes released, I have seen an enormous uptick in my listenership, which I will admit was kind of what I was hoping for. I'm a longtime listener of both of those shows. I enjoy them immensely and respect their hosts for the work they do. So just being able to do episodes with them was a bit surreal. If you had told me a year ago that this would happen, I definitely would not have believed you. But I especially appreciate the platforms they provided me to get the word out about my own show, and it seems to have worked as intended. So a final thank you to both shows for having me on, but also a warm welcome to the new audience members. I'm very excited to see how many are listening, and it has renewed my vigor for working on this show. But one thing I've noticed is lacking are ratings and reviews for the show on the various podcasting services. I hate having to ask, but if you are listening to this right now, please take just 2 minutes to give the show a rating and review. It is a great, free, one-time way to support the show, as it prompts the algorithm to do its thing. And the sooner I get some ratings and reviews, the sooner I get to stop mentioning it at the top of each episode. Okay, did you do it? Thank you. Next, in case you missed it, my Patreon page has been overhauled. There was a whole announcement about it, so go listen to that if you want the details. But all the episodes are currently up at patreon.com/sovietpod. And the page now has multiple tiers with special bonus goodies for each tier, including early access to new episodes and more. As my audience has kind of exploded, so has my support on Patreon. A giant, big, huge thank you to everyone who is chipping in over there. It means so, so much. Okay, with that expression of heartfelt and sincere gratitude to comrades and listeners alike, let's get down to business. When summarizing some of the points of Marxist theory most salient for our show in Episode 1, The Phantom Red Menace, I talked about how Marx, in The 18th Brumaire of Louis Bonaparte, described the peasantry as a quasi-class. As a group, they had certain interests that united and distinguished them, especially in relation toward other classes, such as the landowning aristocracy and the proletariat. But in terms of revolutionary potential, Marx did not believe the peasants had much, specifically because of the geographically diffuse nature of the peasantry, as well as the fact that each peasant family, as a unit, was mostly self-sufficient. This meant that peasants as a group did not necessarily interact with each other toward common goals of production. This was in contradistinction to the proletariat, where every single day, workers were required to, quote, enter into manifold relations with each other, end quote, to produce what they needed, and were physically concentrated in shared workspaces, such as factories and workshops and offices. However, if I left some listeners with a sense that Marx was incredibly dismissive, maybe even disdainful, of the peasantry as a whole, I need to apologize, because Marx, in fact, was not at all disdainful of them as a class or group. He knew from his study of both history and his own time that the peasantry as a class was very powerful, and this he never denied. But what Marx was very skeptical about the revolutionary potential of the peasantry. That is, he did not think the peasantry ultimately would be able to move society as a whole past capitalism and into socialism and communism. In particular, the context for his analysis of the peasantry in the 18th Brumaire is that Marx was writing specifically about the revolution in France in 1848, all of its shortcomings, and the rise of Louis Bonaparte, Napoleon Bonaparte's nephew, as the emperor of the Second French Empire in 1851. Marx concluded that Bonaparte had risen to power, in part, because he had the support of the peasantry in France. His analysis, of course, is vastly more nuanced than that, but what I'm getting at here is Marx was, frankly, disappointed in the role the French peasantry, in particular, had played in the debacle of the rise of Bonaparte, specifically. And so when we read what is perhaps his most well-known analysis of the peasantry and their role in revolutionary movements, we must keep in mind that it was by no means his only such analysis, and that he was mostly discussing the peasantry in a specific time and place, that is, France in the very middle of the 19th century. But the question of the role and revolutionary potential of the peasantry remained one of vital importance to Marxists and socialists throughout the late 19th and early 20th centuries, since the peasantry was, in many countries across the world, still the majority of the population, and in some cases, many times larger than their compatriot proletarian classes. In the case of Russia, as I've mentioned many times already, the peasantry was somewhere around 85% of the overall population of the country, and so Lenin and the Bolsheviks could not avoid forming a theory of the revolutionary role of the peasantry. What they landed on was that the two classes must form an alliance, because they needed each other. We will explore both the theory that was developed around this question and what this relationship actually looked like in practice soon enough, but a very basic outline of the Bolshevik approach to the question of the Russian peasant was that the proletariat had the historical responsibility of being the vanguard class, by virtue of their role in the production of the wealth of bourgeois society, using society's most advanced means of production. However, the peasantry were indispensable, not only due to their numbers, but because they produced almost all the goods and raw materials the proletariat could not produce for itself, including that most important of all materials, food. So the two classes were responsible to each other, and needed each other in order to build a socialist society. When we last checked in with the peasantry in episode 7, The Party and the People, we discussed their general situation in the spring of 1917, and the struggle of the Bolsheviks in trying to sway the peasantry away from the SRs and toward themselves. Since then, our focus has been mostly on the proletariat, the political parties, and the government, with special shoutouts to the soldiery every once in a while. But before we get to the October Revolution, we need to check in once more with the peasantry. Since the revolution will be won by the proletariat, yes, but in many ways, the peasantry created the opening which the proletariat would exploit. And so we are first going to take a more detailed look at the peasants in the fall of 1917, and then step back to place those details, like puzzle pieces, into the wider context of the disintegration facing Russian society at this time. The most critical region for the peasantry in Russia was the Volga Basin in central Russia. In rounded figures, the Volga River is 3,500 kilometers long, or 2,200 miles for us Yanks. It is both the longest river and the largest river basin in Europe. And if you are like me and did not know exactly what a water basin is, it is the area of land which acts as a drainage system for surrounding tributaries and waterways into a central body of water. So the area of land in which water flows into the Volga via surrounding smaller rivers, streams, etc., is 1.3 million square kilometers, or 530,000 square miles. To put that land area in perspective, for Americans, that is almost double the size of Texas, or three quarters the size of Alaska. If you do not know American geography, maybe this will help. The area of the Volga Basin is nearly four times the size of present-day Germany, just a skosh bigger than the country of Peru, and just a tad smaller than Mongolia. So within the Russian Empire itself, we're talking about 6% of its territory in 1916, the last full year of its existence. So yeah, it's huge. In early 20th century Russia, even though serfdom had been abolished decades ago, the landowners and aristocracy of the Volga region still exercised immense power and influence over the people and resources there. This, in turn, engendered some of the fiercest backlash from the peasantry once the Tsar was overthrown, with the highest cases of outright violence and terror against landowners. Perhaps the second most important region in terms of agricultural production and strength of the peasant movement was Ukraine. Ukraine is home to the famous Chernozem, or Black Earth, which is some of the most fertile farming soil in Europe. There is a reason Ukraine was and still is called the breadbasket of Europe, and why empires and nations have fought wars for control over this territory throughout history, up to the present day. In spring of 1917, as we discussed previously, the peasants were willing to wait for a few weeks in order to give the provisional government a chance to get their bearings, with the expectation that their grievances against the landowners and feudal holdovers would be addressed by the much-vaunted Constituent Assembly. But as that assembly kept getting delayed and pushed back and rescheduled, the peasants of the Volga Basin, Ukraine, and across the rest of the country very quickly grew impatient and started taking the initiative themselves. This I have also mentioned in prior episodes, but by the fall of 1917, the situation in the countryside and villages was approaching nuclear meltdown levels of critical mass. It did not matter to the peasantry why the Constituent Assembly was not being called, and why landform was not forthcoming. They did not care whether the provisional government was consciously refusing to address their demands, or if it was simply unable to, either due to lack of resources or because of its own incompetence. None of that mattered, because the effect was the same. The peasants began facing some of the most desperate material conditions in their history, as the chaos that gripped the countryside and villages across the nation led to a near total breakdown in agricultural production. Depending on the geography in question, the peasants were preoccupied with the forests, the fields, the pastures, the crops, and whatever other stereotypically peasant activity was most prevalent. But the one universal constant in the movement across the entire Russian Empire, Republic, I guess now, was the question of control. The peasants wanted control over the means of production they worked. The territory of Ukraine gives a stark example of just how bad things were getting by the sheer scale of its peasant revolt. Ukraine was divided into 624 uyezdy, an uyezd being a municipal unit roughly equivalent to a county in the U.S. By the fall of 1917, 482 of the 624 Ukrainian uyezdy, 77%, were active in the peasant movement against the aristocracy and government. This meant they were ignoring official authorities, acting on their initiative, and seizing control of resources, all of which completely disrupted normal agricultural output. Figures in the various other regions of the country were similar, with reports of peasant activity coming from all over the country: Tagangorsk, Nizhny Novgorod, Vladimir, Shlisselburg, Kursk, Chernigov, Podolsk, Ufa, Tver, Tambov, and everywhere in between. In September, the number of landowner holdings that had been seized directly by the peasantry rose 30% compared to August across the entirety of Russia. By October, it was up another 43%. Along with this rise in seizures came a sharp rise in the cases of violence and even murder of the landowners and their overseers. Such are some of the facts and figures of the peasant movement on the eve of the October Revolution. Now, let us step back and place them in the context of the broader revolutionary movement. Of course, the Bolsheviks were the bugaboo blamed most often for inciting the peasants to violent revolt. And while the majority of peasants did not need encouragement from the Bolsheviks to do what they were doing, it is true that Bolshevik influence was growing even beyond the urban industrial centers, often in proportion to the waning of governmental authority. In at least one case, in Samara, officials from the Ministry of Internal Affairs sent orders to turn over those being charged with criminal activity to the courts. By criminal activity, they meant, of course, violating property rights. But the standing of the provisional government was so abysmal at this point that the ministry received an answer, from the landowners no less, admitting frankly that, quote, circulars without the signatures of the socialist ministers have no force, end quote. By mid-September, Kerensky, as commander-in-chief, was threatening to turn loose the full force of the army against the peasant movement, a move which, as you can imagine, helped his popularity shoot right up. But for reasons we will discuss when we get to the armed forces, it was an open secret of sorts that, with each passing day, Kerensky was losing any authority he might have to follow through on that threat. And absolutely nothing erodes your authority as a leader like making threats that turn out to be idle and issuing orders that are openly ignored with no consequences. Many of the same class dynamics we see in the cities are repeating in the villages. In the urban landscape, we have the bourgeoisie, the proletariat, and the petty bourgeoisie in the middle, where the struggle between the two ends of the class spectrum is for the support of the petty bourgeoisie. In the rural landscape, we have the landowners and the peasantry with the kulaks in the middle. Remember, kulaks were rich peasants who had accumulated some excess land and wealth and were roughly analogous to the petty bourgeoisie in the cities. But whereas in the cities, the petty bourgeoisie were siding more and more with the bourgeoisie, in the countryside, the kulaks were trying their best just to stay out of the fight between the poorer peasants and the landowners. This was because the fight against the landowners at this point was more about trying to destroy the last lingering vestiges of serfdom that had been abolished less than a lifetime ago, and less about overthrowing the incipient capitalism in the countryside. The kulaks as a group did not really have any preference for the outcome of this titanic struggle, other than not getting destroyed themselves. If lingering feudalism in Russia was overthrown, so be it. Such an outcome would remove a social stratum above the kulaks, moving them up in the pecking order. But if the peasant movement failed and the landowners reasserted control over the countryside, well, great. You get to keep your holdings, and you did not even have to do anything. Besides, sticking your neck out was risky, as it might invite reprisals from a victorious land aristocracy. Or, maybe worse, it could attract the attention of the angry mobs of peasants to yourself and your material standing. Not to mention, if the kulaks joined the poorer peasants and the movement gained too much momentum, they might wind up overthrowing the entire system of private property altogether, kulaks and all. No, the smart play here is to simply hunker down for the storm, protect yours, and do your best to emerge in a strong position no matter the outcome. How did this shift in mood and collapse of material conditions in the countryside manifest as political activities during the fall of 1917? The countryside was administered by different institutions existing at different municipal levels. There were the land committees, there were the zemstva we mentioned last time, and there were the Soviets. The municipal levels at which these institutions operated were the gubernia, the rough equivalent of a U.S. state, the uyezd, again, like a U.S. county, and the volost, basically a smaller uyezd. The land committees were official government organs, and they were the most prevalent form of governance in the countryside, existing at all three of these levels. The zemstva were mostly at the volost level, although some were also found at the uyezd level. The Soviets were mostly at the gubernia level, although as 1917 wore on, a scattering of Soviets could be found at the lower uyezd and volost levels. As the official organs of the provisional government in the countryside, the land committees were dominated, at least at first, by the more conservative elements of rural society. The landowners, aristocracy, petty bureaucrats, etc. These groups wanted the committees to play nice with the established order, which was really their established order. But as that order broke down, the committees began to be assailed more and more by the poorer and working peasants, who recognized that the government policy being carried out by the committees was in direct conflict with their interests. At the same time, the Soviets also began to attract the peasants in September and October. This was because the Bolsheviks and left SRs, who were still a rapidly growing faction within the SR party, but not yet a distinct party themselves, began to hold majorities not just in the cities, but in the countryside. The cumulative effect of all this is that by the fall of 1917, with the government and the right SRs almost completely discredited in the eyes of the peasantry, Bolsheviks and left SRs are taking control of the committees and Soviets and taking over the task of organizing agrarian production. What was it exactly about political parties of the SRs, specifically the right SR faction, and the Bolsheviks, that was precipitating this shift in control in the countryside? We have already well established how the right SRs were actually the party of the rich peasants and landowners, and certainly that was the driving force behind everything we are discussing. But it is worth diving into a bit more detail to really appreciate how badly the SRs were screwing up, and how the Bolsheviks and their new allies, the left SRs, were able to capitalize on this. The nominal leadership of the SRs, Viktor Chernov and his ilk, kept saying they wanted to give the land to the peasants. But their approach was to wait for the Constituent Assembly, if it was ever going to be called at this point, where they planned to negotiate with the landowners in an attempt to create a win-win. The grand proposal was the peasants finally get the land, but the landowners are compensated fairly. I don't know about you, but this sounds to me very similar to the redemption payments after the abolition of serfdom in 1861. A real, the peasants have to pay for what should rightfully be theirs kind of arrangement. First their freedom, now their land. Over the course of 1917, the SR party trafficked in a few different slogans here and there, but their fundamental strategy never changed much, and thus it went from seeming like a reasonable, liberal solution in March that encouraged the peasants to be patient, to being completely outdated and at odds with the realities of the peasant movement in October. So as the SR party influence was disintegrating and an insurgent left wing was about to split the party in two, the Bolsheviks were able to exploit the situation and win over, if not a majority of the peasantry, at least a critical mass of it. At a conference of factory committees in Petrograd on the 10th of October, Trotsky spoke about the need for the workers to support the peasants in their struggle against the landowners, so that the peasants could then support the workers. In other words, solidarity between the two classes. They pursued this strategy in a variety of ways. They, of course, reached out to the left wing of the SR party and were successful in joining forces with them. In fact, we will see once we get to the actual revolution, and I swear to you we are almost there, that the Bolsheviks and left SRs wind up forming a coalition and working together quite nicely, at least for a time. But the Bolsheviks did not limit themselves to an alliance with the more radical elements of the peasantry already organized into a political faction. They also actively pursued their own attempts at organizing the peasants. Soldiers and peasant Soviets from across the country that were focused around the urban industrial centers, and therefore heavily influenced and often outright led by the Bolsheviks, sent delegates back to their homes to engage in direct political agitation with the peasants. The testimonials from these delegates also played their part in radicalizing the countryside and attracting that critical mass of the peasantry to the revolutionary left. As for the messaging, we have seen many examples up to now of the Bolsheviks being alone in consistently supporting the demands of the masses. But perhaps no slogan from 1917 better encapsulates the political savvy of the Bolshevik Party than their most famous slogan from that year, Peace, Land, Bread. This slogan, I would argue, was even more effective than the slogan, All Power to the Soviets, since all power was an explicit political demand that they adopted, then discarded when they thought the Soviets were a dead letter, then revived when the Soviets themselves became more combative in the wake of the Kornilov affair. Peace, Land, Bread, however, was about the universal and immediate material demands of what amounted to a combined 95% of the population of Russia. With the promises of peace for the soldiers, land for the peasants, and bread for the workers, it really was quite effective. Before moving on, though, I would like to address a common misinterpretation of this slogan I see all the time. Almost without fail, any mention of the slogan peace, land, bread is accompanied by the implication that it was this slogan alone that allowed the Bolsheviks to mesmerize and hypnotize the masses of Russia into doing their bidding. This is, of course, nonsense. Ask any political organizer and they will tell you, slogans are not spells, and people, whether they are voters in an established system or masses driven to desperation during a revolution, cannot be put under spells. What slogans do, one of the things anyway, is grab the attention of the people whose attention you want to grab. Once that attention is yours, you now have an opportunity to have a more direct conversation with your audience, where you listen to their grievances and explain your position and why that position is the best approach at addressing said grievances. Ideally, it is at this point that enough people make the conscious, deliberate decision to join your political movement. See? No hypnosis. The slogan is simply the verbal equivalent of an ad. It is something to make the people perk up their ears and maybe listen to what you have to say more. Slogans are not substitutes for organizing. Of course, overuse can lead to the effectiveness of slogans waning. Whether it is a particular slogan shouted too many times or becoming outdated, or a saturation of many slogans that causes the individual to become numb to the messaging. So it is not the case that slogans are always effective and never detrimental to a movement. But my point here is that the slogan, Peace, Land, Bread, was not a magic incantation the Bolsheviks were able to conjure and use to manipulate hapless workers and peasants. It was a powerful, inspirational message in an increasingly grim political landscape of a nation falling apart at the seams. The people of Russia were facing increasingly dire material privations and had lost almost all confidence that their self-appointed leaders would ever do anything to actually help them. So it should be no wonder that this slogan, coupled with the legwork of agitation and direct organizing of the masses, came to reap such potent results for the Bolsheviks. If you are enjoying this show and you are in a position to do so, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. I have some good news and bad news. The good news is, I'm happy to say the Patreon page is fully functional now. All my current episodes have been posted there. There are different tiers with different bonuses, and we are forming a nice little community. The bad news is, you are listening to this episode late. All new episodes come out immediately on Patreon first, but then 10 days later on the RSS feed. Early access on Patreon starts at just $5 a month, so if you don't want to wait, head on over and sign up. Also, please leave a rating and review on whatever podcast services you are using, and please share the show with anyone you think might be interested. The more we get the word out, the more our community grows. Now, back to the show. As the summer turned to fall in 1917, the armed forces were yet another cauldron that was boiling over and threatening to spray scalding oil all over the leaders of Russia. There is going to be quite a bit of overlap with the peasantry in this section, since the majority of soldiers and sailors for the armed forces were drafted from the peasantry, and so the mountains of dead soldiers were really mountains of dead peasants. But, as with the last section, we are going to cover some basic statistics that help us understand the scope of the disaster facing the armed forces, before placing them into the grander puzzle of the revolution. Statistics for the Russian armed forces at this time are imprecise, and I have mentioned a few of these figures in previous episodes. But here I want to present a complete and wider selection of some of the more accepted figures, to help understand the scope of the damage wrought by the war. Russia mobilized around 12 million men into the armed forces for World War I. Most estimates put the number of military personnel who died in combat at between 1.7 and 2.3 million soldiers in the span of 3.5 years of fighting. Just that estimated number of dead is roughly equivalent to the entire population of the state of West Virginia, and represented at the time between 1 and 1.5% of the entire population of the Russian Empire. But crucially, this was also 5% of the demographic of men 15 to 49 that were chosen for service, the same men who would normally be home working the land for their families and communities. Estimates for the total number of casualties counted as killed, wounded, or missing come in around 5.5 million. So the death rate for soldiers in the war was, depending on what number you go with in the 1.7 to 2.3 million estimate range, is between 14 and 19%. The overall casualty rate of 5.5 million represents 46% of all military personnel serving in the war. Now, those numbers are bad enough, but it does not stop there. Because, of course, the civilian population were also casualties of the war, albeit indirectly. A common figure given is 1.5 million dead from starvation, disease, and displacement. And finally, it is widely, although to be fair, not universally, acknowledged that economic collapse leads directly to higher mortality rates as well. Which is to say, in addition to the roughly 7 million military and civilian casualties usually attributed to the war, there's simply no telling how many additional people died as collateral of the general economic collapse facing Russia in the war years. 7 million estimated dead or wounded from the war, for a population estimated to have been at the start of the war around 175 million. That works out to 4% of the population of the Russian Empire. Now, that percentage might not seem like a big deal, but if we translate those numbers to the United States of our day, with an estimated 340 million people living here as of 2024, that works out to 13.6 million people dead in the span of 3 years. Ask any demographer, the deaths of over 13 million people over 3 years would represent an apocalyptic downshift in the population, from which it would take decades for the United States to recover. But okay, enough talk about numbers. Let's talk about the day-to-day existence of the average soldier or sailor in the fall of 1917. The material conditions in the army had deteriorated to such a degree it would hardly be accurate to call it an army anymore. Due to the chaos gripping the country in both industrial and agricultural production, supplies for the army had almost completely disappeared from the front. You name it, the soldiers either did not have it, or were close to running out completely. We are talking everything from food, clothing, and boots, to ammunition, rifles, and military vehicles. The commander of the Northern Front reported that, quote, "hunger is the main reason for the collapse in morale," end quote. Courts-martial ground to a halt for the simple reason that soldiers flat-out refused summons to appear, either for trial or as witnesses. Officers who might have tried to effect those summons and enforce the courts were ignored, and in the face of masses of soldiers outright refusing orders, there was no way to enforce any authority. Some officers, particularly despised either for their cruel discipline, their open disdain for the soldiers, or for being suspected of trying to push the continuation of the war, were arrested or killed. The barracks and trenches these soldiers lived in were also falling apart. Literally, the trenches were caving in and the barracks were collapsing everywhere, or they were flooding, or their waste drainage systems stopped working, or all of the above. But as if all this was not bad enough, as absolutely ridiculous and incredible as it may seem, rumors began going around that the government was planning yet another offensive in the mold of the much-despised June Offensive. Now, in fairness, these rumors were only partially true, or I guess more accurately, they were premature. No specific plans had been drawn up yet, but the pre-parliament, the advisory political body formed by the Democratic Conference in September, which we discussed briefly last episode, was trying to come up with ways to raise the combat readiness of the armed forces in preparation for a new offensive. But would it at all surprise you, even in the least, to learn that the competing factions of the pre-parliament could not agree on even how to achieve this one task of raising combat readiness? No? Me neither. The Mensheviks and SRs spoke of inspiring the armed forces to fight, while the rightists in the pre-parliament spoke of forcing them to fight. The Bolsheviks at this point had actually left the pre-parliament, something we will explore in more detail next time, but that means that, of course, they were not part of these discussions, nor would they have been. But so, the two sides went back and forth, with one side pointing out to the other there were no means of doing what that side was calling for. And both sides were correct. The soldiers were done fighting. They took inspiration from absolutely nothing anymore, while the near universal breakdown in discipline meant there were no means of forcing the continuation of combat. In other words, what they were discussing was the stark reality. The Russian war effort had almost completely run out of steam. In fact, although nobody yet knew it, there were only 5 months left of Russia's participation in the war. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. The effect these rumors had on the armed forces was devastating. The Baltic fleet was in tatters after multiple engagements with the Germans, and hearing talk from the provisional government of continuing the war finally pushed them over the edge. The Committee of the Army, Navy, and Workers in Finland was the popular organ of the rank-and-file masses. It was not an official government organ, and so in protest to the government, it started authorizing and affecting the holding and delaying of government shipments. Kerensky threatened to arrest the Soviet commissars in the committee he thought were responsible. But Trotsky quotes the committee as having replied, quote, "The Oblast Committee calmly accepts the challenge from the provisional government," end quote. Note, an oblast was and still is a distinct municipal level in Russia, like the gubernia, uyezd, and volost, and was the municipal designation in use for this committee. So in other words, the sailors said, "Come arrest us, if you think you can." To this message from the committee, Kerensky never responded, which basically put the Baltic fleet in an undeclared state of mutiny. If the rightists and the army leaders sitting safely in Petrograd in their government offices kept going on and on about the need to continue the war, to impose discipline and win back, I don't know, Russia's honor or something, army officers stationed on the front could not escape the reality that the war was lost. Many of them wrote in official correspondences, in personal correspondences, and in their journals, that the rumors of a planned offensive were absolute madness, and the thought of trying to organize another offensive filled them with dread and despair. How did this shift in mood and collapse of material conditions in the armed forces manifest as political activities during the fall of 1917? It is in the answer to this question that we see most of the overlap between the soldiers and the wider peasantry. Because it was in the armed forces that the peasants received their most comprehensive and rapid political education, spurred on by their lived experiences. At the front, peasant soldiers were forced into social relations with each other. In city barracks, most notably Petrograd and Moscow, but also nearly every other major urban center, peasant soldiers came into direct contact with the quickly radicalizing proletariat. I mentioned just a few moments ago that, as the political crisis deepened, many of the soldiers and peasant Soviets in cities across the country sent delegates back out to the villages to agitate for a more class-conscious position among their kin. And while it is certainly laudable that so many Soviet representatives endeavored to take their message back to the countryside in order to inspire and lead, I have to be honest here. In terms of raw numbers, these delegates were dwarfed by the soldiers who were simply abandoning the front and returning home. Their experiences also counted for much, and as the Bolsheviks made more and more headway into the committees and Soviets of the armed forces, more and more of these peasant soldiers returning home carried the messages of the Bolshevik Party with them. So as the SR Party is splitting into left and right, the 1-2 punch of official delegates visiting from urban Soviets and the influx of soldiers returning from the front, both agitating on behalf of the Bolsheviks, served to engender in large portions of the poor peasantry a more favorable view of the Bolsheviks. And now, to bring it all the way back around to the peasant movement, we can see just why the provisional government was becoming increasingly impotent in the countryside in the face of widespread peasant revolt. The only institution that Kerensky had at his disposal to quell the peasants was the armed forces. But because the soldiers were themselves on the verge of complete and total mutiny, and lacked the physical resources to do the job even if they wanted to, the government was, in the end, unable to do anything to stem the social upheaval that was roiling the countryside. This, in turn, is what I mean when I say the peasants opened the door for the proletariat to effect a revolution through the Bolshevik Party. The peasant rebellion was simultaneously the most material and existential threat to the legitimacy of the provisional government. Material because in a majority agrarian, semi-feudal, proto-capitalist economy like Russia in 1917, the collapse of the agrarian economy is the sweep-the-leg move that puts the entire system face down on the mat. The downstream effects of the collapse of agricultural production are catastrophic. Imagine a situation in Russia where the peasants are mostly content and the countryside is calm and productive, but the workers in the cities are still pursuing a revolutionary strategy. It is immediately evident in such a scenario just how much harder it would be for the proletariat to emerge victorious against the bourgeoisie and its government. If that government only has to deal with an upstart 10% of the population as urban workers, but the countryside is able to keep the army supplied and fed, I think we can all agree what the most likely outcome would be. But it was also an existential threat because if that large of the majority of the population, what is effectively the entire country, openly hates you and flaunts your authority, and if the only real means your government has of imposing its will and projecting its authority is lost to it, do you even have any authority to begin with? Is it a government if it lacks the ability to enforce its own laws? Isn't that, in the end, what is supposed to make a government a government? We can see here by the fall of 1917, the Russian military had completely exhausted itself. The inability of the ruling classes to solve the problems gripping Russian society throughout that fateful year was, by October, an obvious impediment to restoring the functionality of Russian society at large. The countryside was in shambles. The armed forces were in open revolt and on the verge of literally physically collapsing. And of course, we know that the urban centers, not just Petrograd and Moscow, but Nizhny Novgorod, Tver, Kiev, Saratov, Tsaritsyna, and everywhere else, were gripped by workers having joined the Bolshevik Party and demanding an end to the provisional government. There is a phrase about this period of the revolution, the final days of the provisional government, that is often attributed to Lenin, although I could not find any actual evidence he said or wrote it anywhere. But still, it is a brilliantly succinct phrase, and it definitely sounds like something Lenin would have said, so I think he should get the credit. The phrase is, "Power was lying in the streets, we had only to pick it up." Although my pedantic tic feels compelled to point out that a more direct translation would be, "Power lay about under our feet, It was necessary only to seize it. Regardless, the implication is clear. By the end of October, the authority of the provisional government had completely disintegrated, leaving a power vacuum in the country. The Bolsheviks needed only to step in to fill it. I hope by shifting focus from Petrograd, the proletariat, and the party, this discussion has demonstrated just how accurate a summation this phrase was for the situation in the country as a whole. It was not just the workers and the factories that were demanding an end to the government. It was the peasants and soldiers too. It was not just industrial production that collapsed. The entirety of the Russian economy had ground to a halt. Everyone blamed the government for their ills, and they were right to do so. Next time, we will have a kind of speed run through the final weeks before the Bolshevik seizure of power. Because while it is true that it was only necessary to seize power, the process of seizing power is, well, a process. It does not just happen overnight. Of course, the closer we get to the fateful date of the 25th of October, the more that there is to go over. This makes sense. The October Revolution is one of the most earth-shattering events in human history, but only because so many things all come to a head at once. So next time, we are going to power through the return of Lenin to Petrograd, his struggle within the Bolshevik Party for a policy of immediate seizure of power, and the formation and political activities of the Military Revolutionary Committee of the Bolshevik Party. After this, the table will finally be set for what I, many communists around the world, and I hope you agree by now, is one of the most pivotal and inspirational turning points in the history of human civilization, the Great October Revolution. One final thing before wrapping up here. I have put out, along with this episode, a supplemental called The Life of Natasha Morozova. This supplemental is not a translation of primary sources, but is, instead, a brief fictional accounting of the life of a peasant woman from a small village in the Volga region from the end of the 19th into the 20th centuries. The story is entirely my own. All I can say is, inspiration struck. If you listen to it, I hope you enjoy it. I welcome any feedback, positive, negative, I do not mind, as long as it is not mean-spirited. Think of The Life of Natasha Morozova as an experiment for the show. If it is well-received, and inspiration strikes again, who knows, maybe I will craft more such supplementals in the future. But if it is not well-received, or inspiration never visits me again, I guess this will be a one-off kind of curiosity in the show's run. Thank you for listening. All translations from the Russian text are provided by me, unless otherwise noted. Any errors or inaccuracies are therefore my own. If you are enjoying the show, please consider supporting me at patreon.com/sovietpod. There are tiers with different incentives, and we're also forming a really nice community over there, so go check it out. A special thank you to my commissars, Comrade Red, Hyacinth Tathini, and Josue Ponce. You guys are awesome. If you have not done so already, please leave a rating and review on your podcast service of choice, and share this show with anyone you think might enjoy it. Also, feel free to reach out to me on Patreon or at sovietpod@gmail.com if you have any questions, feedback, or just want to say hi. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Sickle and the Hammer, a socialist history of the Soviet Union. До свидания.